I want to invite you to get a Bible and open it to Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, here in just a moment, we're going to continue a study that we began in our first session, that is the high cost of getting even. And these two lessons can kind of stand on their own, so those who are not here for the first lesson, you're not going to be left out in the cold. I'll bring up the major points from the last lesson and bring everyone to the same page. But we were considering here the cost of getting even. Jeremiah 17:9 tells us, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? Retaliation, revenge, striking back, getting even, that's common. That's the natural response for most people, whether they are a Christian or not. Whenever someone wrongs you, the natural human response is inclined to retaliate and is inclined to strike back. Whether that slight is against us is small or great, the natural response of man is to get even. And we observed that in the first lesson. While you may be able to retaliate, while you may enjoy vengeance, sweet taste for just a moment, getting even carries with it a very high cost, as we considered some of the things that getting even will cost us. It will cost you peace of mind as you think and as you stew and as you consider what you can do to strike back against those who have wronged you. It will cost you broken health, those who are so consumed by their desire for revenge, who allow bitterness to dwell within them and bring on all sort of additional problems on their own health. Cost you a happy home if you retaliate with your spouse, tit for tat, or with your children. You strike out against them or they strike out against you in frustration and in anger. It will cost you a happy home. Will cost you words and actions that you will regret saying and doing. But once that's done, it can't be undone. It'll cost you the remembrance of God's grace. As we all who have obeyed the gospel, beneficiaries of the blood of Jesus and the forgiveness that His death brings us. When you set out on a quest for vengeance to retaliate, you forget what God's done you as He saw the mountain of debt that was piled up against you. And He released you from that in Jesus Christ in faith when He said your sins are no longer imputed to you. You're forgiven when He has removed that. How can we then go and set forth on a quest that will retaliate to someone else for some small minor thing that they've done in contrast to what we've done for God? If you pursue vengeance, then you will forget the grace of God. And most importantly, it'll cost you your fellowship with God. God is light. And the one who says, I hate my brother, and that's what we do whenever we seek to strike back, to retaliate, and to get revenge. We can't have fellowship with God. So let's set Paul's words before us again as we continue thinking about the high cost of getting even. Romans chapter 12, let's start again in verse 14. Paul's instruction toward the church at Rome is they deal with an oppressive people, maybe oppressive brethren, an oppressive government. His words to those who mistreat them, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind one toward another and do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. Never pay back evil for evil. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. And if he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. When I think of Paul's commendation to the church at Rome, never take your own revenge, I think of a fictional character named Edmond Dantes, who is an Alexander Dumas' story, The Count of Monte Cristo. And they made a movie. So if you haven't read the story, it's probably more likely that you saw the movie with Jim Caviezel. Follows the book pretty closely, though. But young Edmond is a man who seems to be living a perfect life. He has just been promoted to captain of a trade ship. He is engaged to marry his beautiful wife, the love of his life. He has one-upped his best friend in a game that they have played since they were young. And for him, things just don't seem like they can get any better. However, shortly after his success, he is betrayed by this jealous friend and is sent to a high-security prison where he spends the next 21 years of his life locked up in solitary confinement. In that time, he manages to meet a priest who in there educates him and teaches him how to fight, and more important, teaches him how to think logically. And so he's able to work through this process of how he was betrayed, who betrayed him, and how he ended up being cast in prison unlawfully. And he finally manages to escape. He secures the lost treasure and he reemerges into society as the Count of Monte Cristo. While he was in prison, he was able to trace each of the people who wronged him and committed this lie and perpetrated this lie against him. He was able to determine who was involved in having him unlawfully put in prison. And so he sets out in hopes of exacting this grand plan of revenge. And he's on the verge of giving up life and light and money and love until he realizes finally that revenge is not the answer. When I think of revenge in the Bible, I think of the story of David, David's children, Tamar, Amnon, and Absalom. And we know the story. Amnon is convinced that he is in love with his half-sister Tamar. And so he devises this plan to fake ill and have his father send Tamar to bring food to him and care for him. And David does so. And while Tamar is there, he takes advantage of her, believing that this was going to consummate this love that he had for her, which in actuality was lust. After that event, he couldn't stand the sight of her and he sent her away. Meanwhile, her brother Absalom doesn't say a word to Amnon. He plots and he waits for the right moment. And finally, when that time comes, Absalom kills Amnon in an act of revenge for what he has done to his sister. Now, we recognize that both of these examples are extreme. And they're a demonstration of a person who is harboring bitterness and a spirit of revenge that simply does not belong in the life of a Christian. But one of the mistakes that we oftentimes make in the self-examination process is we conjure up the person who has committed an offense similar to ours, but we look at the most extreme case of that particular sin. And all of a sudden, if we look at Amnon and people like that, Absalom, well, we may say, well, what I'm doing in the spirit of revenge, it's a similar spirit of theirs, is by no means comparable to the wrongness of theirs, and therefore, this little subtle act of mine, well, it's not that bad after all. When in actuality, by principle, we're committing the same sin that they are. And while there are different degrees of a vengeful heart, and while none of us, I hope, are of a vengeful spirit similar to that of Absalom, we may very well be guilty of committing the same type of sin. So I want to break this last study and further down a little bit more. I want to consider, as we can think about the high cost of getting even, I want to think about relationships, and this is where we'll spend the larger part of our lesson. So when we get done with the first half, don't get scared if we're almost out of time. We're going to spend most of our time dedicated to the relationships that I believe give way to tit-for-tat revenge, and we'll talk more about that later on. And then we'll conclude with some application, and we'll consider how we can approach God's Word and what are some attitudes that we can have that will put to rest perhaps our heart's desire to seek out revenge against those who wrong us. You would think the act of getting even would be reserved for people who wrong us, people who hurt us, people we don't like, and people who don't like us. Not that even in such situations is it right for a person to take revenge and retaliation into their own hands. But you would think, if I'm going to strike out against someone and stoop to their level and harm them or hurt them with my words or my deeds, that it's going to be a person who has done that to me, whom I don't like and who doesn't like me. However, there's an old saying that I've found to be quite true. Those we love most are those we hurt most. And that's where I want us to start. Because I think a lot of the getting even that Christians do is not the Absalom-esque type sin where we carry that hatred and bitterness to this great, terrible sin that results, say, in the murder of one's brother, but rather smaller and subtler ways. Yet we can be guilty of the very same thing. The relationship, I believe, that is perhaps the most conducive to revenge is that of marriage. Look with me in 2 Samuel chapter 6. 2 Samuel chapter 6. Marriage is a relationship that I believe just opens the door for a lot of tit for tat, I keep calling it, back and forth, small things. You do a little something to me, I'm going to do a little something to you. And I'm not talking about the Absalom type revenge, although I suppose perhaps there have been instances where that has occurred. But rather, you hurt my feelings, so I'm going to fantasize about all the terrible things that I'd like to say to you, or I'd love to happen to you in that moment of anger. Or you've wronged me, so I'm going to do a little something, I'm going to get you back. Or you're unkind to me, so I'm going to be unkind to you. Or you started an argument with me, so I'm going to make sure that I have the last word. These little back and forth acts of unkindness can suck the love right out of a marriage. You can put it in his grave. 2 Samuel chapter 6, we see a very joyous scene, or what should be a very joyous scene. The Ark of the Covenant has been living on the outskirts of Israel for some 50 years or so. Eli's sons took it into battle that they were losing. They thought that it would perhaps be for them a good luck charm, and that having God's Ark of the Covenant there would bring victory to them over the Philistines. As it turns out, their wickedness superseded that, and the Israelites lost the battle, and those two men that took the Ark of the Covenant into battle lost it and their life as well. But it dwelt outside of the area of Israel for about 50 years, that is, until David decides to bring it back. And it's only after a miserable failing where a man named Uzzah came on a very bad end in that regard that David goes back to the law of Moses, figures out how the Ark of the Covenant is to be transported in the prescribed manner, and then brings it home as God intended him to do. So that's the context of 2 Samuel 6, is the Ark of the Covenant, been gone for 50 years, is coming to Jerusalem, the capital city. Let's read in 2 Samuel 6, starting in verse 12. Now it was told King David, saying, "The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him on account of the Ark of God." David went up, and he brought the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom into the city of David with gladness. And so it was that when the bearers of the Ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling. And David danced, verse 14, before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all his house were bringing up the Ark of the Lord with shouting and the sound of the trumpet. And then it happened, as the Ark of the Lord came into the city of David, that Michal, daughter of Saul, wife of David, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. She despised him in her heart. Michal is David's first wife. And this is where the trouble starts. Husband does something to make wife mad. Classic scenario. David's leading the Ark's procession with singing and dancing and celebration and joy. Michal looks out the window. She sees David and how he's acting and how she thinks that's demeaning. King shouldn't act like that. King shouldn't dress like that. So she despised him in his heart. Now, we're not looking at the rightness and wrongness of Michal and David. As we're going to see in just a moment, both of them, I believe, were wrong in the way that they handled this issue. What I want us to see, rather, is this getting even spirit that seemed to reside in both of them and what it did to their marriage. Look down in verse 20. When David returned to bless the household, his household, Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today. He uncovered himself today in the eyes of his servants' maids, as one of the foolish ones shamelessly uncovers himself." So David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore I will celebrate before the Lord, and I'll be more lightly esteemed than this, and will be humble in my own eyes. But with the maids of whom you have spoken, with them I will be distinguished." Verse 23, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. David has angered Michal. And I don't think she's wrong for bringing what David has done, what's caused her to be angry. I don't think she's wrong for bringing her concern to David, to his attention. However, her mistake was made in timing and tone. David's come back to bless his family as the Ark of God has finally returned home. And Michal jumps in right there in front of everybody. Now, we don't know who was there and who witnessed this. What we know is rather than waiting until they had a private moment and then expressing her concern, it says she went out to meet him. And she jumps him in front of everyone that's there. And you can just hear the sarcasm and the condescension in her voice as she says, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today." This is her retaliation against David because she is angry from what she's seen him do. Now pause. What should David do? By the way, in our marriages, whenever we find ourselves wanting to lash out in anger and retaliate in anger, pause. Think about it. Like we're doing with David. How should David respond? How should I respond in that moment of frustration? Too often we speak or think or act or act and then we regret it later. We should stop and think about it. But what should David have done? Well, he could have ignored it. That would have been a good option. He could have recognized that this was a word that was spoken in haste by his wife. He could have cooled off and let her cool off. And then when they're both level-headed, they could have revisited the subject. But like many of us, both husbands and wives have done, we say, "Nuh-uh, I'm not going to let that pass." David strikes back. He brings her father into the argument. By the way, that's a bad idea. Don't bring your in-laws into an argument with your spouse. Nothing good, I promise you, will come of that. But that's what David does. He says, "God chose me instead of your father. He gave Israel to me. And if you think I made a fool of myself dancing in front of these people, I promise you these young women hold me with honor. And here's the result, verse 23. Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Now, I think David might have resolved this differently if Michal had been his only wife. However, God allowed David to have more so. But she wasn't. And I don't think as we read verse 23, we're looking at the divine curse of God. Oftentimes you see that where God has allowed a woman to become barren for whatever reason, whether to bless her later or as a result of some means of punishment. And it tells us usually God was involved with that. We don't see that being the result. That's why I don't think this was really God doing anything. This is not some divine curse on Michal because she did something wrong, because David was just as wrong in the way he reacted to her. Rather, what I think we see is this tit-for-tat getting even business, that essentially their marriage and their love was killed in this moment because both of them had a vengeful spirit toward one another and said, no, you're not getting the last word. That's going to be mine. The reality is we oftentimes laugh at the little back and forth that takes place in marriage, but there's nothing funny about it. A husband upsets his wife and his buddy says, well, he's going to be out in the doghouse tonight, and we'll laugh. Or a wife upsets her husband and her friends say, well, he'll be sleeping on the couch tonight. But behind these seemingly insignificant actions is an attitude that says, I'm going to get even. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying it's wrong to be upset with your spouse. I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong to allow your feelings to impact your tone or your warmth. Sometimes we have to let things process. Sometimes time has to pass and we have to think through things. It's always wise to let your anger subside before you start to act. But it's not wrong to be negatively necessarily affected by your spouses. However, it is always wrong to retaliate when they wrong us. Sort of retaliation can look like this. And as I said before, when we're talking about the spirit of getting even, I think we're talking about something much more broad than, or much more specific than what we saw with Absalom, which he got angry and killed his brother. I think we're looking at something that, there's more of what getting even looks like in a marriage, perhaps, today. It's subtle, but yet it's retaliatory at the same time. The silent treatment. Now, I understand there's this need sometimes to think and to cool off. And there is this, you hurt my feelings and I'm going to have to work through that. But if you give somebody, give your spouse the silent treatment simply because they wronged you, that's wrong. I'm not saying it's wrong to not necessarily speak to your spouse or take time to process things. But if you're responding to a wrong that they did to you, it's always wrong to retaliate in that way. That's very subtle. But yet how many times have we been guilty of doing that with our spouses when they've done something small to slight us? The cold shoulder. Keeping score. Keeping count of wrongs done. Holding things over the other's head. Oftentimes, these little actions back and forth are born out of this attitude that says, you've upset me, you've hurt me, I'm going to hurt you. And let me make this clear. This is, I think, what happened here with David and Michal. The marriage bed never, never should be used as leverage. Abstinence is never, under any circumstance in the marriage, intended to be a means of punishment. That's born out of this sinful attitude, and it's wrong. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, the husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, I understand 1 Corinthians 7 has been badly abused by many Christian people, many Christian husbands and wives, to force their spouse to enter into a physical relationship that is not appropriate. And there are times to enjoy that aspect of the marriage relationship. There are times to refrain from it. But under no circumstance should the marriage bed ever be used as leverage or as payback or as retaliation against your spouse. Paul makes it clear depriving one another is to be by agreement for the purpose of individually drawing closer to God. One more verse and we'll move on. Look in Ephesians chapter 4. Got a lot of marriage advice whenever Whitney and I first got married. Most of it was bad. A little of it was good. So let me pass on one of the pieces of advice that was given to me by Dennis Caro that stuck with me and I believe has positively affected our marriage. Now, the context of Ephesians 4 is not marriage. However, this is a very good principle to apply to a marriage. Ephesians chapter 4, Look down in verse 26. Be angry, and yet do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. There are going to be times when you get angry with one another. You can't live in such close proximity to another person so frequently and not get angry at them. But the Bible doesn't say, don't get angry. The Bible says, be angry and do not sin. And I think it's always a good to reconcile before you go to bed. Whatever the problem is, if it's possible, I understand it may not always be possible, but most of the time it is, in the little things and the little disagreements it is, reconcile before you go to bed. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. You're not doing yourselves any favors. But any negative action in retaliation in a marriage is always wrong simply because you're trying to even the score. Whether it may be something as big as striking your spouse or something as small as giving them the silent treatment. If it's born out of the motive, I'm doing this to get even, sinful. And that's all there is to it. Romans 12, never pay back anyone evil for evil. Never take your own revenge. And most certainly this applies to the relationship that we should hold most dear next to that between us and the Lord. Look with me in Luke chapter 15. Another relationship where getting even is likely to occur is family. Whether it be child to parent, parent to child, sibling to sibling, so forth and so on. Once again, I think Christians need to be on guard, not of the extreme Absalom type sin of revenge, but rather the small, petty things that are often done of a vengeful spirit. Now, we know the story of Luke 15 well. It's one of my favorites. The beloved story of the prodigal son. A man has two sons. The younger comes up to his father and demands his inheritance. And the father divides his wealth, giving two-thirds to his older son and one-third to his younger son. And the younger son then takes his share of the inheritance, goes off into this Gentile country, and devours his father's assets on prodigal living. And as he finally finds himself there in the middle of this herd of swine, he realizes dad knew what was best after all. And so he humbles himself and he returns home with the intent of serving as a slave in his father's household for the rest of his life. When he gets back, dad's not ready to pour out his revenge. He hasn't got this angry diatribe that he's going to pour on him and make sure everybody knows how much of a disappointment he is. And he's going to retaliate for all of the humiliation that he suffered the day that his son left. He eagerly pours out his mercy and love on his son. And he brings him clothes and shoes and a ring, all of which is a very extravagant way of the father saying, not a slave, you're a son. And the son's relationship to his father is restored when he returns, when he repents. And he goes on to have this fattened calf slaughtered and invites the whole town to celebration because my son who was dead is alive again. Now here's where we want to pick up our reading in Luke 15, starting in verse 25. Now, when his older son was in the field, and when he came up and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he summoned one of the servants and been inquiring what these things could be. And he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. But he became angry, was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. But he answered and said to his father, look, for so many years I have been serving you, and I have never neglected a command of yours. And yet you've never given me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours comes, who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you kill the fattened calf for him. And he said, son, you've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this your brother was dead and has begun to live, and he was lost and has been found. Not everybody is happy when the prodigal returns. When Big Bro finds out that Junior's back and Dad's throwing a party to celebrate, he starts to sulk. Now, maybe we may want to justify the actions of the older brother in his frustration and his anger to say, well, he's got a right to be mad. He was faithful. He never left Dad's side. While the younger brother was out living the good life, wasting his father's inheritance was in actuality wasn't as grand as Satan promised him it was going to be. But then returns, he's welcomed with open arms. Sure, Big Brother's got a right to be mad. Does he? I think the point of Jesus' parable is Big Brother doesn't have a right to be mad. We may have an only child, or two in the audience, but I think most of us probably have a sibling, have a brother or sister. Let me ask you this. You're serving the Lord faithfully, and your brother or your sister leaves the Lord, and their soul is in jeopardy. What is the ever-present prayer that dwells in your heart? Well, if you love them, as the Bible tells you to love them, is that they come back. Is that they return. If they were to come back, would you be angry? Hopefully not. But if you are, you'd be like the brother in this story. You've stayed at home with dad. They've gone and they've lived the good life. But then they return and God restores fellowship with open arms. Is that fair? The older brother was wanting revenge. He wanted revenge. He wanted to get even. Little bro went out and had a big old time. He wasted his money. And then he comes crawling back to dad. And you know what, dad? I think we need to pay him back a little bit for what he's done. I think we need to make him grovel. I think we need to put him to work and make him pay back every dime that he wasted. Big brother won't come in and celebrate because he's bitter. He's vengeful. He doesn't want to see mercy. He wants to see justice. And we are imperfect people. I wasn't always the brother I should have been. Wasn't always the son that I should have been. But I think it's safe to say, to this day, I'm probably not always the son or brother that I should be. But you know what I need in those moments when I'm not the brother or the son that I need to be? I need parents, and I need brothers, I need aunts, and I need uncles, who when I speak out of place or out of turn or when I act unkindly, rather than saying, I'm not going to forget what you did, or you're going to have to pay for that. I need loved ones that are going to say to me, that's okay. I'm going to extend forgiveness rather than seek vengeance. Proverbs 17:9, whoever covers an offense seeks love, but one who dwells on it will alienate a friend. And by the way, which action or rather reaction do you think is going to bring the lost one who's returned closer to the Lord? Is it the act of revenge or is it the act of forgiveness? Don't seek revenge when someone in your family does wrong and then has the humility to return, to repent, to seek to make that right. Not only is it wrong to act out of a vengeful spirit, but it often pushes them further away from you. More importantly, oftentimes from God. We'll conclude the first half of the sermon with this thought. We need to be sure that we don't possess a vengeful spirit toward those who reject the gospel. Look with me in Luke 9. If there's a single statement that summarizes Jesus' purpose in coming to this earth, as far as it pertains to me and you, the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which is lost. I think that encapsulates what Jesus came here to do. The Son of Man came to seek and to save that which is lost. The reason Jesus left heaven, the reason Jesus came to earth, the reason Jesus endured suffering and shame and humiliation, the reason he allowed himself to be lifted up on a tree and put to death was so that he could save man from sin and bring people to God. Let's read Luke 9:5 and make a quick observation. As for you, Luke 9:5, as for those who do not receive you, as you go out from the city, shake the dust off of your feet as a testimony to them. Now, this is a phrase we use, shaking the dust off of our feet. Someone doesn't want to hear the gospel. Someone responds negatively. Well, I'm going to shake the dust off my feet. Let that be that. You had your chance. I'm going to go on. This comes as at the tail end of what we call the limited commission. The disciples aren't sent to all the world, to all the nations, rather they're sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, strictly to the Jews. And Jesus says, I want you to go, I want you to teach, I want you to preach, and I want you to heal the sick. However, if someone doesn't want to have anything to do with you, then when you leave the city, you're to shake the dust from your feet as a testimony against them. Now, after hearing Jesus say that, you can imagine why James and John act the way they do a little further down in Luke 9, starting in verse 51. When his days were approaching for his ascension, Jesus was determined to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead of him, and they went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. But they did not receive him because he was traveling toward Jerusalem. When the disciples James and John saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them and said, you don't know what kind of spirit you're of, for the Son of Man didn't come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went on to another village. Luke tells in his gospel of an encounter of Jesus had with one of the Samaritan villages. And as Jesus is approaching this village and sends a couple of apostles ahead to make arrangements for their arrival, when that village finds out Jesus is going to Jerusalem, that place of worship where only the Jews are allowed to go, well, they say, well, you know what? We don't need Jesus here. Y'all just travel on down the road. When James and John hear about the Samaritans' rejection of Jesus, they say, Lord, do you want us to bring down fire from heaven and burn them up? By the way, even great men, James and John, apostles of Jesus, struggled with this temptation of getting even with those who wronged them. Let me just say, I can relate to James and John. They're offended on Jesus' behalf. They've seen his power. They've heard his preaching. They've witnessed his miracles. They believe he's the Messiah of Israel, the King of the Jews. And as the king prepares to enter this dinky little Samaritan village, they say, "We don't want you here." Okay, you don't want Jesus here? You don't want the king here? That's fine. Why don't we just bring down fire and burn you all up, and that way you'll be getting what you deserve? Let me just say, I get James and John. You ever offer somebody the gospel only to have them turn up their nose at it? Maybe you invite them to church. Maybe you sat down and studied. Maybe you tried to correct something that they misunderstood. Maybe you just tried to have a spiritual conversation with them. But for whatever reason, they make it clear under no uncertain terms that they are not interested in what you have to say. And had I been following Jesus, whenever that Samaritan village says, "No, go another way," then I'd have been like James and John. "Lord, you want me to bring down fire and burn them to a crisp? If that's how you're going to be, if that's how you're going to respond to Jesus in his presence, well, you know what? We're going to give you what you deserve." What so oftentimes fuels those thoughts and those reactions is a vengeful spirit. "You've rejected me. Now I'm going to get even with you. You're going to get what's coming to you one day." It's grounded in this sinful attitude of revenge. I think that's partly why Jesus says, or the Lord rather says, if they reject you, it's not really you they're rejecting. It's me. See, I don't have to strike out in revenge whenever someone turns down my invitation to listen to the gospel, to hear of Jesus. Because it's not really me they're rejecting, it's God himself. And so I don't need to seek vengeance on God's behalf. I'll throw these in by way of, just for the sake of them being relevant relationships that open themselves to revenge, and we won't talk about them, but just keep them in mind. In the church, you often have a lot of this back and forth, "I'm going to get you," eye for an eye kind of business taking place in the church, and that is no way going to help the church and has no place in a church, much less anywhere else. And then those who wrong us, we seek to retaliate and respond in kind. So let's spend the last few minutes that we have talking about, well, how can I deal with this vengeful spirit, this temptation to strike back against those who wrong me? Essentially, this is an attitude that I'm going to retaliate, I'm going to get even, which we know the dangers that pride possesses, and I think that's rooted and grounded in pride. So it's an attitude that we've got to seek to replace the vengeful heart with. I think it starts with this, a spirit of humility. In James 4:6, we're told that God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. We've coined a phrase that Jesus uses in the Sermon on the Mount, and in doing so, I believe we have kind of robbed it of its power. Matthew 5:38 and 39, "You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him." And so we say, somebody wrongs you, turn the other cheek. Under the law of Moses, it was an eye for an eye. The law of Moses leans toward justice. And I believe that the law of Christ leans toward grace and mercy. Neither, that's not a hard rule. I just believe the general tenor of the old was justice and the general tenor of the new is grace and mercy. But the word resist, where Jesus says, "Do not resist the evil one," the word resist means to stand opposed, to stand against, to oppose. And Jesus isn't saying, you need to lay down and let people who are going to take advantage of you take advantage of you and just give them whatever they ask for and just lay down and let them beat you like a rug. That's not what Jesus is saying. At the same time, we do need to give consideration to what Jesus is saying, where he says, when someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to them. Well, somebody out here, I don't know who, but somebody's going to come up to me and say, after the sermon, well, if somebody slapped you on the right cheek, you're not going to turn the other cheek to them. You're going to duck the next time they slap you. Well, that's not what Jesus said here. I understand that this isn't a literal example, but Jesus is comparing two extremes that are both wrong. Don't let somebody walk all over you to the point that you just allow them to take whatever they want, even your own life, if that were to be the case. Likewise, don't retaliate. Don't seek to get revenge on your own. Don't seek to oppose them. Don't stand up and say, no, you're not doing that to me. I'm going to get you back. His point is, don't seek personal vengeance when someone wrongs you. Being slapped in the face is one of the most humiliating things that a person can suffer. It requires a tremendous amount of humility to have someone slap you in the face and to not do anything about it, to not think anything negative about them. But Jesus did. Jesus did. The soldiers blindfolded him and slapped him and said, if you're the Son of God, if you're the Christ, tell us who hit you. And they took him, they put the crown of thorns on his head. They took a stick and they beat him over the head with it. How humiliating is that? They spit in his face. Jesus endured the ultimate humiliation, the greatest, most degrading things a man can. And despite having the power to retaliate, he didn't. And he tells us, don't seek vengeance out. Don't retaliate. Don't do this eye for an eye business anymore. Because as Paul says in Philippians 2, Jesus humbled himself, took on the form of a bondservant, was put to death, even the death on the cross. Endure the wrong. Do not seek your own revenge. Have an attitude of humility. You've got to have a spirit of love. Whoever wrongs you, whether it's your spouse or your kids or your parents or your friend, what you need to demonstrate and what you need to have in that moment is a spirit of love to endure it. Matthew 5:44, I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Don't strike them back. Love them. Don't get revenge. Love them. Don't seek to get even. Love them. Maybe whenever someone wrongs us, we don't act in revenge. We're in control of our body, and although every impulse says, punch them back, we control our physical response and we don't do anything to them. We don't make them pay. We resist that urge. But let's carry that to perfection, as I believe God would have us to do. I may not physically retaliate when someone wrongs me, but you know what I might do? I might think some pretty unkind things about them and smile at the satisfaction thinking those thoughts gives me. I might envision myself saying or doing something to them to put them in their place. No, I'm not acting on those thoughts, but I'm entertaining them. But if the Sermon on the Mount teaches us one thing, what is it? If you think it, you might as well have done it. It tells us that, yeah, you may say, I didn't do that, so I'm not wrong. Jesus says, if you think it, you do it. It's wrong to commit adultery, but it's not wrong to think about it. Jesus says, yes, it is. It's not wrong to, it's wrong to kill somebody, but it's not wrong to hate my brother. Jesus says, yes, it is. To do something and entertain something with one's mind is the same in regard to the eyes of God as doing it. So rather than just resisting the desire to physically retaliate, resist the desire to mentally retaliate, to say those things in your mind and enjoy them in the privacy of your own thoughts. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. We're going to need a spirit of forgiveness. Just like the father in the story of the prodigal son, who wasn't waiting on his son to come home so he could enact revenge. He wasn't trying to pay him back for the grief his son caused. His mind was consumed with the desire of forgiving his sons to make that relationship right. Remember the last words of Samson in the book of Judges? Philistines have captured him. They blinded him. They're using him like a beast of burden to grind grain into meal. And they bring him out at this huge party so they can laugh at him and make fun of him and relish in his humiliation. Samson feels the strength of God return to him. He's placed between these two pillars. Remember his last words? As he literally brings down the house on his enemies with his final breath. Let me have revenge for my two eyes. Now contrast that with the last words of Jesus. His enemies too have him captured. His enemies too are humiliating him. His enemies too have put him on display for others to look at and to mock and to laugh at. And rather than asking God, give these people what they deserve, Jesus prays, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. We got to be like Jesus. When someone wrongs us, great or small, we've got to extend forgiveness. And finally, we have to have a spirit of trust. We'll conclude in Romans 12 where we began and bring our lesson full circle. Romans 12 and verse 19 rather. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Vengeance belongs to God. Let me say, it's not wrong to feel that justice should be done. In Revelation, we see a scene where this altar is pulled back and there are these souls that have been killed for their faith in Jesus. And they cry out to God, how long, O Lord, until you avenge our blood? And you know, God doesn't look at them and say, you know, guys, that's not an attitude that you need to have. God says, sons and daughters, it's not going to be long until I enact revenge. It's not wrong to desire justice, to yearn for justice, to want justice to be served. As I think about some of the greatest injustices in the world, I long for justice. When I read about the great atrocity of abortion being committed, I yearn strongly for justice. Whenever I read about parents abusing their children, I yearn for justice. Whenever I hear about someone who's gone and gotten drunk and drives into a family and kills the family and they walk away without a scratch, I yearn for justice. It's not wrong to desire that justice be done. What's wrong is for me to be the one to try to take justice into my own hands. That being said, in our quest for justice, we would do well to remember the justice that would be shown to us were God to hold us accountable for our wrongs. Let's trust in God. He'll repay. He'll enact vengeance. And He'll dispense mercy to those who will humble themselves. When we seek revenge, we're questioning God's wisdom and God's timing. We're failing to demonstrate the forgiveness that has been extended to us, and we are cutting short the long-suffering and mercy of God. We are stepping into His authority and putting on shoes that we have no right to put on. If you're here this morning and you realize that I've lived with this subtle attitude of retaliation and revenge, I hope you make those changes in your life. They can destroy a marriage. They can destroy relationships between loved ones. They can destroy relationships between brethren. Put those away. Put on humility, forgiveness, love, and trust in God to make all things right. If you're here this morning, you've not responded to the gospel of Jesus. As we said, when Jesus stood up and said, today is the day of grace, today is the day of salvation, He cut short Isaiah's phrase that He's going to bring forth the day of vengeance for the Lord. But He's going to stand up one day, and He's going to announce an end of all things, and the day of grace will end, and the day of vengeance on those who have not obeyed the gospel, who are living outside of Christ, will be enacted in its full power. If you need to make your life right by giving your life to Jesus and obeying the gospel for the first time, you need to make your life right by coming forward, confessing sin that's committed in your life. You can do that. Maybe you just need to go home, get on your knees, and get right with the Lord to make sure you're ready for that day when He does return. If anyone needs to respond to the invitation, we ask you to do so as we stand and as we sing.